yes, join me. Yes, I want this. I want this power. I need this power. No. Any accusation is false. Then once Imam Ali al-Salam was stitching his shoes, there was no more room to stitch. And Salman comes to him and says, Amir al-Mu'mineen, tell me, give me some hidayah. He says, you see, this shoe is more valuable to me than that seat, than that khilafah. It's more valuable to me. But I stand by it because Allah commanded me for that. I will protect it because Allah has given me that. It is mine. But it's not because I want power. It's because I need to save you. I need to give justice to you. Who's going to guide you? Who's going to give you justice? This is the power of Imam Ali alayhi salam. That when he says that to Maytham al-Thammar, that Maytham is killed because he says you can handle it. Some people can't handle it. That Imam Ali alayhi salam was on the death state. So people ask, how come Allah did not mention the name of Imam Ali in this surah? Or in this ayah, for example, إِنَّمَا وَلِيكُمُ اللَّهِ. When he says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. Why not just say, وَأَمِيرُ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ عَلِيمُ نَبِي طَالِبٍ. Why don't you mention this name? People ask. It is not in the spirit of the Quran. Look at the wisdom of Allah. Allah doesn't mention a single companion of the Prophet in the entire Quran except one. And his name was Zayd, who was his adopted son. And only strategically his name is mentioned. Why? All the companions, none of their names are mentioned. Because it's not the style of the Quran to be giving us stories with names. The Quran has remained silent for all the companions of the Prophet. Do you know why? Subhanallah. Look at the wisdom of the Quran. The Quran is a book of principles. It's not a book of stories. And if there is a story in it, it's because there's a principle behind it. Otherwise, the Quran doesn't tell us. Even the Quran is silent about how many people were in the cave. Quran in Surah Al-Kahf, they say, you argue, there were 5 and 6 as a dog, 6 and 7 as a... No, I'm not going to tell you. You say to Allah, why don't you tell me? Because Allah says, it's not important for you. I'll tell you only if it's important. And if numbers are given to you, it's important. You will find out later in time about this number. So Imam Ali's name is not mentioned because you and I have been commanded, إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا بِاللَّهِ وَرَسُولِي ثُمَّ لَمْ يَرْتَابُوا وَجَاهَدُوا بِأَمْوَالِهِمْ وَأَنفُسِهِمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. The believers are the ones who believe in Allah and His Messenger. Through the Messenger, we get all the regulations.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Good to have you with us. My name is Amina Taylor, broadcasting from the British capital, London. Now we kick off with a developing story after the European Parliament voted to lift the immunity of the former president of Spain's Catalonia region, Carles Puigdemont, and two of his pro-independence associates. Puigdemont and his colleagues became members of the European Parliament in 2019. This after they fled Spain following their failed pro-independence Catalan referendum bid, which was deemed illegal by Spanish authorities. Following the EU's announcements, Puigdemont's pro-Catalan party stated that they will not give up the fight for independence. The three individuals now face being extradited to Spain, which has issued European arrest warrants for the trio. Chris Bambury is with me, the political commentator and author of the book Catalonia Reborn, How Catalonia Took on the Corrupt Spanish State and the Legacy of Franco. You've been watching this for some time. Are you surprised that the EU did this?
No, I'm not surprised. The Spanish are desperate to get Puigdemont and the other two back to put them in jail, as with the other Catalan leaders who were sentenced to Oriol Junqueras, for instance, to 13 years for organising this referendum. I think the result was not going to be in any surprise. The three major blocs in the European Parliament, centre-right blocs and the socialist centre-left blocs, had all agreed they were going to vote for this. But actually, the result was much closer than would be expected. 58% voted for lifting the immunity, and you could do the rest of the arithmetic. A substantial minority voted against. And this was the first time that the Catalan issue has really erupted into the European Parliament and European institutions. Since that October referendum, which was suppressed by the Spanish using paramilitary police, the EU has stayed quiet on the question of Catalonia and what's happening there, because essentially it supports Spain. Now we have a debate in Europe about what is going on, not just in Catalonia, but inside Spain. And we should remember as well that this vote comes off the back of the imprisonment of a rapper, a Catalan rapper, for the crime of insulting the royal family and the Spanish security forces. That caused a debate on the nature of Spanish democracy. This is causing a further debate on the nature of Spanish democracy. Questions are now being asked in Europe, which is not a bad thing.
But how will this impact the independence push by Catalonia? We know that, of course, the pro-independence party won a slim majority in the last election just a few weeks ago.
Well, of course, a majority of Catalans in last month's election voted for pro-independence parties. But that hasn't stopped the Spanish continuing a heavy-handed policy, essentially of low-key repression in Catalonia, persecuting politicians, mayors, social activists, clowns. You know, someone who wore a red nose next to a cop, Spanish cop, was sentenced. This policy has been going on. But I think what's also interesting about this, the vote last night, the result announced this morning, is that up until recently, the Catalans were looking for the EU to help. Catalonia was traditionally pro-EU. Now people are looking at this and saying, what democracy is here? The initial decision to lift the immunity was taken by a subcommittee of the European Parliament, chaired by a unionist Spanish MP. And there were eight Spanish unionist MPs on that committee, ranging from the socialists through to the far-right Vox. That doesn't sound right. And although the socialists are now in government in Madrid, keep saying they want dialogue, we keep having legal actions against independent supporters. So increasingly, number of Catalans can't see there's any hope of finding a legal way out under the Spanish constitution, because this is being blocked, but also see the European Union as supporting the Spanish state throughout this.
Now,
but
do
the
you
good
see
news
very
is,
briefly,
as I say, this
Chris,
debate has erupted into Europe, and secondly, it's also erupted into Spain. The Spanish government is split with a junior partner in the current coalition, Podemos, opposing, they voted against this, their MEPs voted against this. They oppose the jailing of the rapper. They oppose the jailing of the Catalan political leaders. And this is beginning to cause a debate in Spain on the very nature of Spanish democracy, which, again, can only help towards a resolution of the Catalan issue.
All right, we're going to watch this case closely because, after all, as you say, these three individuals face lengthy jail sentences if returned to Spain. Thank you very much, Chris Bambury, as always. Now, the fallout from the bombshell interview involving former British royals, Prince Harry, and his wife, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, continues to dominate the front pages in the United Kingdom. After the initial shock from the couple's accusations of racism and animosity in the royal court, questions are now being asked about what it all means for the royal family that they left behind. Well, Saïd Pourreza may have some answers.
The worst royal crisis in 85 years, says one headline today, one of the many others in the British press, following that tell-all tale by the British Queen's grandson and his wife. perhaps the most damning of allegations, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex's claims of racist conversations by a senior royal about the color of their unborn baby's skin.
The royal family, the institution, is a monument to British white supremacy. It is rooted in Britain's shameful legacy of colonialism and empire. And that mentality pervades the institution, it pervades everybody who works for the institution, and it certainly occupies the minds of the royal family itself.
The two-hour-long interview has drawn high-profile vows of support, even from the White House, and howls of protest from some commentators in Britain.
This is a two-hour trash-a-thon of our royal family.
From the UK's political elite, cautious reaction to the former royal's explosive allegations. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer said they had to be taken very seriously, and the Prime Minister refused to be drawn into the controversy.
I've always had the highest admiration for the Queen and the unifying role that she plays in our country.
But now, you know, now we've got our family.
Watched by an average of 11.1 million people in the UK, the interview bears eerie similarities to another one a quarter century ago of Princess Diana, Princess Harry's mother, who broke her silence about life among the British royals.
This has had an earth-shattering impact. The royal family has not been plunged into a crisis as serious as this since the abdication of Edward VIII in 1936.
Decades later, and as the world digests the incendiary details about the Windsor family, questions are being asked about the British monarchy's continued relevance in the 21st century.
I don't think the family garners anything like the respect it used to have in the hearts and minds of the masses. And I think this young lady, this biracial lady, has opened up Pandora's box and she's raised huge consciousness. Abolish the monarchy was a hashtag that's been trending on Twitter in the UK for the last few days since the interview. You would never have imagined such a thing the day before this interview.
The mantra at Buckingham Palace is usually to say very little. We're yet to see what will come out of the ongoing crisis talks in the building behind me. But whatever the response, there is no escaping the fact that the British royal family won't come out of this crisis unscathed. Saeed Pourreza, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Never thought I'd be doing lengthy royal reporting on this channel, but it's a little bit deeper than that, is it not, Ahmed Kabbala? Because it's not just about the institution, but the other elements that it's thrown up about Britain. Tell me more.
Yeah, it's raised important questions about race relations in the UK, about the idea of a royal family in 21st century Britain, particularly when such a powerful, wealthy family is so concerned about the pigmentation levels of a baby that is three quarters white and has one African-American grandparent. And people are starting to ask, what is the purpose of the royal family? What role do they serve? And how they deploy the tabloid press to target certain members of the family, like Meghan Markle, when she's not singing from the same hymn sheet as the rest of the royals, or before her, Princess Diana, but yet they use those same aspects of the tabloid press to protect Prince Andrew, who's been accused of the most vicious and vile crimes of sexually assaulting a minor. And people are starting to think, what is this about? Particularly when people in the royal family come forward and say that they're feeling suicidal, having problems with their mental health, and yet the institution of the royal family takes those concerns, and instead of thinking about how to help the individual, they think about how this could damage the reputation of the royal family and say to the individual that they cannot get help. And that's the new thing that's come out since yesterday, because the interview was aired for the first time yesterday in the UK, and that's one of the major points that people are talking about, with Meghan Markle talking about trying to come forward about her mental health problems. Let's play that.
Look, I was really ashamed to say it at the time, and ashamed to have to admit it to Harry especially, because I know how much loss he suffered.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that if I didn't say it, that I would do it. And I just didn't want to be alive anymore.
Difficult stuff there, Ahmed.
It really is. And what's interesting about this is all she tried to do was have some sort of privacy and leave the royal family. And she's received such horrendous abuse. And one of those most culpable for abusing her on a regular basis is a TV British broadcaster by the name of Piers Morgan. But yesterday, he actually got a taste of his own medicine when Dr. Shola gave him a history lesson about what the royal family actually represents and its colonial links. Let's play that video.
What kind of grandmother will protect her own son, Prince Andrew, from the potential crime of raping a minor, but will do jack all to protect Harry and Meghan? Especially, I have no doubt that she would have heard about the suicidal thoughts and the help and support she needs. And then you sit there hammering on about how the royal institution is so racist. Are you out of your godforsaken mind?
No, you know what? I find what you're saying about the Queen actually disgraceful.
We've got some social media reactions. So Jerry says, imagine bringing your wife and kid to America because it's less racist. Stedman says, imagine how racist you've got to be worried about your three quarters white baby's skin tone. And more social media reaction related to Piers Morgan. But before we get to that, we've got a third and final video where Piers Morgan is debating with his colleague, Alex Beresford, and Piers Morgan actually walks off the stage. Now let's play that video.
And I understand that you don't like Meghan Markle. You've made it so clear a number of times on this program, a number of times. And I understand that you've got a personal relationship with Meghan Markle, or had one, and she cut you off. She's entitled to cut you off if she wants to. Has she said anything about you since she cut you off? I don't think she has, but yet you continue to trash her.
Okay, I'm done with this.
No.
Sorry, no.
Do you know what? That's pathetic.
You can trash me, maybe, not my
no,
own.
No.
See you later.
I'm being...
Sorry, can't
this
do this.
Is absolutely diabolical behaviour. I'm sorry, but Piers spouts off on a regular basis, and we all have to sit there and listen. 6:30 to 7 o'clock yesterday was incredibly hard to watch.
Let me have just a brief reaction there, Ahmed. One of your best.
Okay, so final tweet from Will Black. He says, coward Piers Morgan flouncing from his own program when challenged on his bullying of a pregnant woman is a joy to behold, but really he should be sacked. Public figures should not be paid to abuse people, as it helps to create a culture of racism and misogyny. And as John White said, this is bringing a constitutional crisis. It brings into question the very purpose of the monarchy, and who knows how this drama will unfold.
And as you said to me off the air, perhaps she's not seen as a revolutionary figure, Ahmed, but just the fact that she had abolished the monarchy trending because of the impact of this interview may well mean she does a revolutionary thing after all. Thank you so much. Glad I stole that one from you. Thank you. All right, we move on to another story now, because Russia has called on the U.S. to put an end to its so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in order for the historic 2015 nuclear deal to get back on track. In a message posted on social media, Russian diplomat Mikhail Ulanov said that it was time for Washington to, quote, ensure the normal functioning of the nuclear deal, the most important component of the nuclear non-proliferation regime. His comments come weeks after the Biden administration stated that it was ready to engage in dialogue with Iran about a return to the 2015 accord. This after Tehran stated it would return to full compliance once the U.S. had lifted its unilateral sanctions. Italy has surpassed 100,000 coronavirus deaths a year after it became the first country in the world to impose a national lockdown to halt the spread of the virus. Italy has the second highest number of deaths in Europe, as the UK currently leads with close to 125,000 dead. The total number of infections in Italy surpassed 3 million last week after a surge in cases powered by the highly contagious variant that was first identified in Britain towards the end of 2020. Like the rest of the EU, Italy's vaccination campaign has got off to a slow start, hit in part by delivery delays from drug manufacturers. Now, China has urged the UK's media regulator to revoke the decision to fine CGTN, China's English language satellite news channel. British regulator Ofcom announced on Monday that it would be fining the channel £225,000 for breaching rules on fairness, privacy, and due impartiality. This just weeks after it stripped the network of its right to air in the UK. In a tit-for-tat move, China stated that it firmly opposes the fine, whilst adding that the British regulator should do more to punish British media for untrue reporting on China and Hong Kong. Richard Sudan, what links a terror organization, in the view of many, with a key man from Donald Trump's old administration?
That's a million-dollar question, Amina. A pretty astounding headline, really. Oath Keepers seen with Roger Stone, the Trump advisor, is arrested, reports say. Now, of course, the Oath Keepers are a white supremacist armed militia. Some call them a terror group. Now, Roger Stone is a longtime advisor for Donald Trump, and one of the Oath Keepers, Roberto Minuto, was actually pictured with Roger Stone on the morning of January the 6th, which was, of course, the day of the riots in D.C. This photo is of Washington, D.C. That's Roberto Minuto on the left and Roger Stone in the center there. Now, Roberto Minuto has actually been arrested in connection, people are saying, with the riots themselves, which raises some serious questions, as you mentioned in your introduction, about the proximity, really, of Trump's kind of inner circle with those implicated potentially in the DC riots. Now, I think at the moment there's about six Oath Keepers who have been arrested in connection with the riots themselves. And now we're sort of hearing this, and the Oath Keeper in question was actually providing security for Mr. Stone on the day itself. Now, Roger Stone has denied any prior knowledge of the riots, which basically followed the picture you just saw. But it raises questions not just about Roger Stone, not just about Donald Trump even, but we've seen many examples surface in recent weeks, really, you know, showing potentially very close ties between groups which people are saying are white supremacist, possibly terror groups, and the very kind of inner echelons of government. So a lot of questions are really being raised with this story, Amina.
This after we saw Secret Service agents with other members of other terror groups in the minds of some people. It does, there's some very serious questions, and are those questions being mirrored on social media?
They certainly are. Let's go first to Daryl Davis, who says very pertinently, why would Roger Stone use a terrorist group like the Oath Keepers for security? Seems either really dumb or really complicit. Tariq Nasheed says, I told people 6 years ago here on Twitter that the Oath Keepers were a government-affiliated, deputized white supremacist group. One of the top members who is affiliated with Roger Stone was arrested for his role in the Capitol riots. And we have a reaction from Gary, who says, the insidious cartoon-like Roger Stone, whom Trump pardoned, who has been trying to bring fascism to America since 1972. Big question mark there.
Next story for me, Richard.
A very harrowing one. The headline says, wrongful death lawsuit has been filed on behalf of Daniel Prude's kids against the city of Rochester. Daniel Prude was a man who died following what many people are saying extremely excessive police restraint in Rochester in New York in March of 2020. He was having a serious mental health episode. People are saying not only did he not pose a threat, he was extremely vulnerable. The police had been called to help Mr. Prude. I just want to roll a clip of the incident itself.
Get on the ground. Put your hands behind your back. Behind your back.
Yes,
don't
sir.
Move.
Yes.
Don't move.
Yes,
chill
sir.
Out, man. Don't move, all right, man?
Yes,
just don't
sir.
Move.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Hey. take your mask off.
One male in custody.
The man, Richard, who to my untrained ears was sounding compliant. I heard yes sir, no sirs. So how did we end up in this situation where he lost his life?
He was compliant, and just to be clear, he was face down, naked, in the street. People are saying posing no threat whatsoever. One of the officers who attended basically put his body weight on Mr. Prude's neck. The officers in the longer video can then be heard speaking. There's no medical attention administered to this man. It was only when the paramedics turned up, they administered that help. This man actually also said, "I'm dying," at the time. And just to emphasize, the police were called because this was a mental health crisis and that, you know, the family of Mr. Prude needed assistance. Now, no police officers were ever charged for this incident. That result happened in February, and now the family are filing a federal lawsuit against the city of Rochester, citing civil rights reasons for that. And actually, this case, Amina, was one of the ones which really galvanized the Black Lives Matter protests that we saw building momentum last year. And many people are really raising this case very loudly. They want justice for Mr. Prude and for his family.
And because we're knowing today that they're doing jury selection in the case of Derek Chauvin, the lead police officer who did have his foot on the neck of George Floyd, the parallels can't be underestimated at the moment. That is the institution of policing in the United States that needs root and branch reforms.
Absolutely, and people are also saying, look, you know, there's a whole system really that needs reforming. You know, you've got issues around judges, juries, the whole systemic side of it that you mentioned. And of course, the other big thing here is that we've seen many examples, first of all, of excessive violence, people are saying, by Rochester police, but also how many examples of police being called to deal with very sensitive, vulnerable people with mental health issues, and yet time and time again, after contact with the police, these people end up dead. And, you know, many people, Amina, are saying enough is enough, and this is what leads to the calls to not just reform the police, but defund them entirely, particularly Rochester police.
All right, let's crack on with two of your tweets very quickly.
Stephanie says, not one cop indicted after a video shows police put a naked Daniel Prude in a spit hood. He ends up dead. And Iman says, Rochester police killed Daniel Prude and they pepper sprayed and handcuffed a 9-year-old. And today we learn they pepper sprayed a 3-year-old. No amount of reform will end this abuse and state-sanctioned violence. This department must be defunded, reprimanded, and reparations for the families must be given.
Let's hope justice is well and truly served, Richard Sudan. Thank you so much, and thank you to everyone who took the time to stay with us.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters all around the globe, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program in IRIB English Radio and the program for humanity. And I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi. We're talking about the treatise of rights, the hadith, which is from Imam Sajjad Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, the great grandchild of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, and particularly the right of the one who seeks advice from you, Haqqul Mustashir. The Arabic text goes as follows: وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْمُسْتَشِيرِ فَإِنْ حَضَرَكَ لَهُ وَجْهُ رَأْيٍ جَهَدْتَ لَهُ فِي النَّصِيحَةِ وَأَشَرْتَ عَلَيْهِ بِمَا تَعْلَمُ أَنَّكَ لَوْ كُنْتَ مَكَانُهُ عَمِلْتَ بِهِ وَذَلِكَ لِيَكُمْ مِنْكَ فِي رَحْمَةٍ وَلِينَ فَإِنَّ اللِّينَ يُؤْنِسُ الْوَحْشَةَ وَإِنَّ الْغِلْذَ يُوحِشُ مَوْدِعَ الْأُنْسِ. The English translation goes as follows: and the right of him who seeks your advice is that you should exert all efforts to advise him if you can provide him with a good opinion, and suggest to him to choose what you would have chosen if you were in his shoes. You should do so with mercy and with lenience, since lenience would eliminate fear, while rudeness will eliminate friendliness. Such is the word of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in the book The Treatise of Rights. In this part of The Treatise of Rights, Imam Sajjad makes it obligatory for us as Muslims to first of all be a good advisor, and second of all to give advice with lenient, soft voice, or in a lenient style without being harsh. A Muslim advisor to his nation is the one who loves doing good and is devoted to the interest of Muslims. He is the one who, when given responsibility, practicing a profession or assuming leadership, preserves Muslim property and interest, and guides the Muslims towards good acts and obedience to Allah the Almighty. Giving advice can be done through a good speech, sermon, or lecture. It can be done through publications and broadcasting also. In the event that our good and Islamic advice falls on deaf ears of unjust rulers and scholars, in that case, Muslims should cut their relations with them and not cooperate with them. They should strive to replace them with good and righteous persons. We are going for a small break, dear brothers and sisters. Please join us afterwards.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program for Humanity on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about one of the rights in the book, The Treatise of Rights of Imam Sajjad Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, where he said, you should do so when you give advice. You should do so with mercy and with lenience, since lenience will eliminate fear, while rudeness would eliminate friendliness. And it's a profound advice in this advice, where you should be kind and gentle to everyone that you give an advice to. By being harsh would not lead to a good result. For example, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, gentleness is not to be found in anything, but that it adds to its beauty, and it is not withdrawn from anything, but it makes it defective. And as previously said in other programs, advice is like snow. The softer it falls, the longer it dwells upon, and the deeper it sinks into the mind. So one of the key rules is to give advice in a lenient, soft way and not in a harsh style. Practice what you preach. You have to walk the talk. You cannot say something or give an advice and not follow it yourself. Show some humility. You have to always show some humility. One of the ways to do this is to make it clear that you yourself are willing to ask for and receive advice yourself, and that you are not Mr. Perfect. If you are able to establish this fact for the person you're advising, then that person will automatically accept from you what you have to say. What does the Imam further say? Give advice as if you were in his shoes. Give advice is an act of worship. It's an act of worship. It should not be habitual. For some people, giving advice, for example, turns into a habitual pattern. Sometimes one gives advice to others to avoid dealing with one's own problems. Avoid compelling others to follow your advice. It shouldn't be follow my way or the highway. It shouldn't be a mentality where you say you're with me or you're against me. It shouldn't be a mentality where you say with any means necessary. Avoid compelling others to follow your advice. You should be humble. You should be lenient, as the Imam said. It is obligatory on the advisor to render sincere advice to others, but it is not his right to compel others to follow his advice. One should not give advice on the condition that it must be accepted. If one goes beyond this, he would be oppressing others, not advising, thus seeking obedience and control. That's all for this time, dear brothers and sisters. You can contact us through our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir, and you can also follow us and listen to us in parstoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The United States has bombed Syria more than 20,000 times over the past 8 years. The United States began bombing these ancient lands 30 years ago. The U.S. has continued bombing Iraq and neighboring countries on and off ever since. Each time, Americans have been told that doing so would protect American interests and help bring peace and stability to the region. Yet each period of airstrikes has brought more suffering, more violence, less security, and greater instability. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Robert Kohler, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. War Machine Doesn't Want Americans to Take War Personally. Here's more. For Washington, it seems that whatever the problem is, the answer is bombing, so wrote Stephen Zunes in the wake of Joe Biden's first act of murder as president. Oh, excuse me, his first act of defensive military action, bombing a border post in Syria, recently killing 22. This action, of course, will quickly be forgotten. The United States has bombed Syria more than 20,000 times over the past 8 years, Zunes noted, adding, the United States began bombing these ancient lands 30 years ago. The U.S. has continued bombing Iraq and neighboring countries on and off ever since. Each time, Americans have been told that doing so would protect American interests and help bring peace and stability to the region. Yet, each period of airstrikes has brought more suffering, more violence, less security, and greater instability. It's called, usually with a shrug, endless war. When American citizens ponder this phenomenon, they are endlessly stunned and instantly immobilized. This is just how it is. American citizens devote a trillion or so dollars a year to militarism. The god of war is their ruler, and the job of the guy they elect as president is to slather their every act of war in sophisticated justification, as known as public relations. George W. Bush gave U.S. citizens marching orders 2 decades ago, go shopping. For most Americans, war has simply been converted into a quiet abstraction, with the deaths of civilians conveniently shunted aside as collateral damage. War has nothing to do with them, except of course it does, at least in one way. The nature of war is to beget war, to magnify trouble, to make matters worse. War always comes home. The only way to interrupt the psychological and, of course, financial grip of the God of War has on the American government and much of its population is to shatter war's protective abstractions. Good violence is no better than bad violence. Our violence is no better than theirs. Murder is murder. Before we can talk about peace, release it from its simplistic abstraction. Can we all just get along and begin envisioning it, both individually and collectively, in all its overwhelming complexity? We believe we have to see acts of war for what they are, which is to say, see them the way the victims see them. We have to take them personally. But this is not the normal way of Western media, so we reach beyond the normal, quoting friend and longtime peace activist Kathy Kelly, who bleeds from the heart as she writes about 30 years of America-inflicted hell in the West Asia region, from the highway of death to the shock and awe bombing of Iraq to... Amiria was a Baghdad bunker to which hundreds of people had fled for safety during a U.S. bombing raid. What happened was 2 of U.S. smart bombs went through a ventilation shaft in the bunker, destroying it and killing over 400 people, mostly women and children. Many of them suffocated or burned to death as the temperature in the bunker became unimaginable. Not to worry, though. 30 years on, a U.S. general discussing the bombing with Al Jazeera said the bunker was thought to be a military commander center, explaining, civilian casualties happened. This was a legitimate military target. It was hit precisely. It was destroyed and put out of business, and there was very little collateral damage. You know, only 400 plus people. Kelly Rose, I wish Joe Biden could meet the Pope in Iraq and ask him to hear his confession. This would be the beginning of peace, that is to say, the dawn of national awareness, by which women all of humanity face enormous dangers in the coming years, particularly related to climate change. They must be addressed. But no, we should not start nuking hurricanes. Real threats will not be solved, but they will certainly be amplified by U.S. militarism. However lacking Patty Kelly's imagined scenario in Baghdad, how do we begin transcending the nation's military mindset and the cash flow loop that makes it continually profitable to those in power? As Lindsay Khashoggian writes, the U.S. military reaches around the globe with approximately 800 foreign military installations in nearly half the world's countries, and takes up more than half the discretionary budget that Congress allocates each year. Every decade or two, there is a new rationale for all this, with a new threat, unquote. Is Biden the president with the will and courage to begin standing up to this? American people must challenge him to be that president, channeling the voices of those who would do so if they could, the ones who died at Amiria in Baghdad, and countless other targeted sites, including the Murrah Federal Building.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
خدا دوست نداره کسانی که تکبر بکنن. آخه بر کی تکبر میکنه؟ منی که اول جیفه عرض میشود که
Allah does not like arrogant people. For whom we are arrogant? How can I be arrogant when I was born from a drop of semen? In a story, we read that in the past, a king heard about a very pious man and asked about his address to visit him. The king's men took him to the pious man. He was seated by a wall. After greetings, the king introduced himself and said, "I am the sultan of your city. You can ask me whatever you want." The pious man said, "Can you give me whatever I want?" "Yes," the king answered. The pious man said, "Do you see these flies around me? Please order them to go away because I want to take a rest."
چه کار من نیست؟ گفتی تاری مگس ازاد نمیاد. حالا هر چی میخوای بهت بدم.
The king said, "I can't do this." Then the pious man said, "How do you claim to give me whatever I want when you cannot even order a fly to go away?" The pious man turned to the king and said, "All the things you think you can give me are the trusts of Allah in your hand, and He is the very owner of everything. Therefore, do not claim them to be yours." The important lesson that we must learn from this story is that one must not be arrogant. Of course, this does not mean to leave this world totally. This means to have only trust in Allah and the Ahlul Bayt. Always have trust in Allah, because He is always with you, and He is the one who can save your face, whoever you are. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parstoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.